Millennium Wars. So new imperialism took many different forms. There were some examples where military force was used to take control of foreign lands. Other instances, money was used, involvement in revolutions was sometimes used. But how the English forced down the canton system was probably one of the most diabolical of them all. They would use drugs to try to attempt to seize control of the economy of the most populous nation on earth. War that began just because China, Lin Jiashu, was trying to enforce the law. But the Brits didn't like it, and they would justify their war based upon European standards, protection of property. Now, truth be told, even though the Opium War on paper was 3 years, it wasn't 3 years of constant action. As I've mentioned before, the old wars were measured, including the state of war. So don't think there was constantly soldiers on the ground shooting at one another. That wasn't the case. The war itself, in terms of days, was actually very brief. So what took place went quickly. The war itself began when England demanded compensation. Compensatory damages. They demanded that China pay the value of the opium that was destroyed. Now, by the way, if I was to take your laptop and smash it on the ground, you could take me to court and you could try to seek the same things, compensation, that I would pay you back the damage that I caused. But again, that was a very European standard. Well, when the Qing refused, China lost control of the waters along its coast because the Chinese sailors were sailing these primitive little vessels called junks, whereas the British were using ships of the line. Boats that sometimes had 10, 20, as many as 30 cannon on it. The British fleet, the Brits were able to deploy about 45 vessels, sailing ships, as well as newfangled steam-powered gunboats. The first maneuver, they swept the coast of Chinese resistance, so they controlled the water. Then, once they controlled the coastline, they launched a two-stage operation. First, they were going to send one division up the Yellow River, up the Yellow River towards the city of Nanking. Nanking is where the emperor resided during the summertime. And, simultaneously, in the south, they would attack Canton. The goal essentially was to seize control of the trading post and send a message of fear towards the emperor. Now, both entryways to the Pearl and the Yellow River were guarded by Qing fortresses. But the British artillery laid waste to those structures. Once the defenses were shattered, the Brits occupied both Canton and Shanghai. And the Chinese could not stop this invasion. while the Chinese army had 200,000 soldiers in it, whereas the British army was only about 20,000, although most of them were Indians, as in from India. The reason why China couldn't take advantage of its numbers was because the Brits had better technology. China had a few primitive and ancient matchlock shotgun-like devices, but the vast majority of their soldiers went onto the battlefield with swords and spears. Plus, the cannon that the Chinese had were ancient, hadn't been used for centuries. So when the China tried retaliating with their cannon, most of the cannons blew up. The Brits, on the other hand, the soldiers were armed with muskets, every single one of them. Smoothbore muskets, but they were flintlocked. So basically the soldier would pull the trigger, and there was like a little flint on the trigger that rubbed up like a Zippo lighter, causing a spark. And that spark went into a pan that had gunpowder in it, and it would cause the gun to go. The difference between using an other type of musket, like a matchlock, is when you pulled the trigger, it wasn't predictable when it was going to fire. So you'd pull the trigger, and it may be a second before it went off. So in that time, you could shift your body weight, cause you to take the barrel off the sights. Whereas with the flintlock, it was almost as effective as pulling a trigger on a modern firearm. The British soldiers, well-skilled, highly trained. The Chinese, not as much. So even if the Chinese sent their numbers at the British, it would be a bloodbath. The mental image I always use is that scene from Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when he goes into the middle of that bazaar. And that big, strong, powerful Arab comes out with the big broadsword and it was like, and Indiana Jones just takes out his pistol in one shot and then walks away. Gun beats sword any day of the week. Now, as if that wasn't bad enough, when they penetrated the Yellow River, the Chinese unintentionally gave a gift to the British. Just as the British military vessels were sailing upstream, down the river came the annual tax collections. China had been interconnected for centuries with deep canals called the Grand Canal System. And while it would take time, it was possible to go by boat throughout much of China. It's not the case anymore. And what the Chinese agents would do is every single year they'd collect the taxes, they'd put it on boats, and they'd sail it to the palace. Well, up the river comes the British, down the river comes these tax barges, and the British seize them. Essentially, they had all of the money for that year's annual budget. And the Brits held it hostage. Just like those cyber terrorists do when they seize control of your computer and hold it for ransom. Ironically, with the loss of the taxes, there was no way to pay the soldiers or any of the government agents. So the emperor decided to pursue peace. The emperor at the time was the 8th Qing Emperor, Emperor Daoguang. Well, here's the kicker. China lost. Unlike with what we do today, where we fight wars and we basically rebuild the losers. Back then, when a war was fought, the winner imposed the terms. So England imposes the terms upon China. In a very infamous treaty that marked a huge turning point in the history of China. The Treaty of Nanking, signed in 1842. This treaty was the first of the so-called unequal treaties. It was the first unequal treaty. In other words, this is not a mutual agreement. This is being forced upon the Chinese with unequal terms. And by the way, this treaty would be the framework that would be used with every single treaty with China over the next 70 years. Point number one. China had to open up 5 ports to British trade. 5, not just Canton. Now England was allowed to enter 5 ports. And the British could establish consulates there, so they could set up government offices. So 5 ports with consulates. Point number 2. Christian missionaries had to be allowed in China. Christian missionaries had to be allowed in China. FYI, prior to this law, Europeans were not allowed in China at all. They would be killed on sight. Now missionaries had to be allowed in. Anywhere in China, by the way. Point 3, and this out of all of them is probably the biggest. So much so, I'm going to write it down just because I feel like it. British subjects in China would be granted what's known as extraterritorial rights. Extraterritorial rights. Anyone ever hear this expression before? To make it simple, if a British citizen commits a crime in China, that person is to be arrested and turned over to the British for punishment. So, you go to, say, France, you commit a crime, France is supposed to turn you over to the United States. Why would that be an issue?
British could just lessen the punishment?
Absolutely. Maybe you do something in China that would result in the death penalty. But in England, it's like a slap on the wrist. What happens if China has a crime that's not considered a crime in England?
Just let go.
Yeah, you could be just let go. Like, for instance, the transportation and selling of opium. Illegal in China, but it's perfectly legal in Britain. This would be huge because this standard, which China would agree to, would basically allow the Brits to get away with things that otherwise would be illegal. All right, so five ports plus consulates, missionaries, extraterritorial rights. Point four, Hong Kong would be seized. And it would become a sphere of influence. England would control that city. And by the way, they retained control of Hong Kong all the way up until December 31st, 1999. I remember when it transferred over. I had friends that had friends with people living in Hong Kong. All of them left within 5 years. Because once China got hold of it, they slowly communized it. And I don't know if any of you pay attention to the news, probably not. But earlier in the week, the new government of Hong Kong passed a series of laws that basically eliminated the remnants of British rights. So the people in Hong Kong no longer have a right to own their property. They don't have a right for protection from search and seizure. They don't have privacy rights. Everything has been taken away from them. That's just a tangent. All right, last but not least, damages. Damages. The Brits would demand payment of 21 million ounces of silver. Way more than the market value of the opium that was destroyed. Yeah, let me see. I could do this quick math. See what the current price silver per ounce. Silver market prices today. Wow, trading at almost $25 an ounce. That's the highest I've seen in a while. Geez, maybe I should have listened to that guy on TV and bought silver. All right, hold on. Where's the calculator? Calculator. 25 an ounce times 21. One, two, three. All right, in today's money, that's $525 million. By the way, the moment the French heard about this and the Americans heard about this, they immediately sent ambassadors on warships and demanded the same treaty. So, in 1844, both France and the United States get their own uneven treaty. And essentially, they slowly begin taking over China. Questions? Now, here's the kick. Oh, I didn't realize that was a click. But I don't have what I have underlined. All right. The kick is, these treaties and this treaty all are based on terms. The Treaty of Nanking had a 14-year term, and the French and the British treaties had a 12-year term. So all of these treaties that's allowing the French, the British, and the Americans to start making money all expire in 1856. Ironically, the very same year that the Second Opium War was triggered. The first was about the destruction of property. The Second War, more than anything, was about China's desire to get out of the treaties. And the Europeans wouldn't let them. Questions? Well, beginning in 1855, representatives for the British government, the French government, the United States government, all began attempting to negotiate renewals of the treaty. But in addition to more ports, Christian missionaries, extraterritorial rights, they began demanding more things. Including most favored nation status. Most favored nation status. Any of you ever hear of that before? MFN. Most favored nation status is a standard under international law where foreign countries receive equal treatment under the granting country's laws. So, give you an example. For some stupid reason, I think it was Bill Clinton. I think it was when Clinton was in the office. I don't think it was Bush. Bush the father. I don't think it was Bush the father. And it definitely wasn't Bush the son. Might have been Bill Clinton. No, that's right, because Bill Clinton got caught receiving illegal campaign contributions from the JICOMs. But when Bill Clinton was president of the United States, China received most favorable nation status. So by granting that law, Chinese companies can come into the United States, set up shop, and have to be treated the same as American companies. So they have the same right to buy land, to own buildings, and they pay the same taxes. So if any of you are paying attention, and probably none are, to current affairs, there is definitely, it's constant in the news, the JICOMs are coming in and buying up farmland, and they're also buying properties in and around significant military sites. Because they know our American population isn't paying attention. We're all addicted to our TikToks. So they're slowly invading and getting ready for a war within. That's the reason why I think up to now 70,000 fighting age Chinese suddenly appeared in the border over the last couple of months. But again, we'll keep watching the TikToks and we'll be okay with that.
How long do you think that's going to take?
Well, here's the thing. I've seen polls that suggest that the majority of people in your generation would not, under any circumstance, take up arms to defend the country. So I'm sure they're going to probably wait, maybe not till after the presidential election, but it will probably be in your lifetimes. And by the way, the politicians aren't going to do anything about it because they're all owned by the Chinese. Just FYI. Huge, huge power. Oh, and by the way, just one other reference. Why are the Chinese doing this? Well, the Chinese know their history and they know what the Europeans did to them, and they're doing it exactly to us because, like they, during this time, they weren't paying attention. Just like we're not paying attention. We're too worried about Orange Man bad. Ooh. Well, anyways, the Chinese didn't want to give them this standard. Because the Chinese didn't want British and American and French companies coming into their lands. Plus, the Europeans began demanding opening all of China, not just to missionaries, but to anyone, merchants, businessmen, anyone who the foreign countries wanted to send over. They also wanted legalization of the opium trade, because the Brits wanted to get all of the Chinese hooked on drugs. And they demanded that the Chinese army protect British and French and American merchants from pirates. China did not want to do any of this. So they passively dragged their feet, which of course made the British desperate to exploit anything that could justify a military action. And unfortunately, the Chinese gave it to them. In 1856, the Chinese merchant police stopped and seized a British ship called the HMS Arrow. Now, here's the thing. This is an artist's renditioning of the Arrow, and as you can see, it's actually a Chinese junk. The Arrow, oh, and I'm not saying they're junky. That's what the Chinese called their ships. It was a junk. That's, in English, it's a small ship. So anyways, the Arrow had previously had been used by pirates. The Chinese captured it and then put it up on the market for sale. As it turns out, a British shipping company bought the ship and registered it as a British ship in Hong Kong. But the registration expired. So it technically was not owned by anybody. But it still flew under the British flag. Well, the Chinese merchant police recognized the vessel as a former pirate ship. A bunch of Chinese Marines boarded the ship. They went through the crew and they arrested 12 of them. All Chinese. They alleged they were pirates. Now, FYI, under British law, anyone who sailed under a British flag was considered a British citizen. So the fact that these 12 guys were Chinese citizens didn't matter. The fact that they were on a British ship, working for a British captain, sailing under the flag, meant that they had full protection of the laws of the British. So, when the British consul in Canton got word of this, the ambassador, he demanded not only the immediate release of the crew, but an apology. Because apparently the captain of the Chinese Marines dropped the British flag to the ground. Now, FYI, if you do that to any country's flag, that's an insult to their flag. So the Brits demanded an apology from the insult. So now the ball's in the hands of the Chinese. The Chinese decide 9 of the 12 don't have any criminal records, so they're released. But 3 of them had criminal records in China. So they tell the British, we're going to keep these guys and try them for crimes committed in China. And they did not apologize for the insult to the flag. Because the Chinese agent responded, the ship is not legally British. Because it didn't have a valid registration. Well, when the British governor in Hong Kong learned about this, he ordered his warships to sail to Canton and literally open fire. Because he didn't get an apology for a slight to the flag. And that's how the war started. Well, the Brits essentially would repeat what they did during the first Opium War. They gathered together a large contingency of mostly Indian soldiers. They then landed on the mainland and proceeded to attack targets of extreme importance. But this time, the French joined in. And when news of the declaration of war occurred, not only did the United States jump in, but so did the Russians. Because the chum is in the water, and the sharks are circling. Now, FYI, the United States did not send boots on the ground. They sent mostly small naval ships to help transport the British and the French soldiers upstream. But the Chinese, the Tsar of Russia, he did send a large army that would invade Mongolia. Well, considering they're fighting the militaries of four European powers, the Chinese did not stand a chance. The Chinese had not upgraded their military capability. They had not used any new technology. They once again sent their soldiers out onto the battlefield with swords and shields. I mean, swords and spears. The Brits suffered, and the French, about 2,800 casualties, whereas the Chinese suffered 30,000 killed in actions, KIAs. It was so bad, it was so bloody, that the 9th Qing Emperor, son of Dao Gong, Tian Feng, would sue for peace. But, unlike what his father had done, the new emperor would leave negotiations to his brother, Prince Gong. And let me tell you, Prince Gong does not know how to negotiate. Got it, my friend? Good. What came out of the negotiations was four treaties, and that's why I have it pluralized. There would be four treaties that would be agreed to at the city of Tientsin. There would be one for Britain, one for France, one for Russia, and one for the United States. Building upon the foundation of the Treaty of Nanking, that uneven treaty, the scales continue to tip. This time around, the Europeans demanded the right to set up embassies in Beijing, right next to the palace of the emperor, the Forbidden City. Now, FYI, foreigners had not been allowed into Beijing in hundreds of years unless authorized by the emperor. But they were not allowed to stay in the capital. They could come in, go to the palace, bow before the emperor, but then they left. Well, these four nations demanded the right to set up shop. Two, in addition to the five ports that England and the United States and France already had, China was going to give them 10 more ports. So now all of the Europeans, because they also gave it all to Russia as well, now the Europeans would have access to 15 Chinese ports. Foreigners would be allowed to freely travel anywhere in China. China would no longer be a closed country. It's now to be opened. And other than money, which I'll talk about in a second, the last big thing that all four got was the right to sail up the Yellow River. The Yellow River is one of the great rivers of the world, but Chinese civilization was born along its banks. So the Europeans demanded the right to sail right into the interior of China. Now, as far as money, yeah, the Brits and the French wanted money too. War costs. This time around, England wanted 7 million ounces of silver, about a third of what they got previously, and France wanted 3.5 million ounces of silver. Well, when you add it all up together, this is outrageous. So when the prince brought this back to the emperor, there's Prince Gong himself, the emperor refused. He was not going to sign this. And instead, he ordered his generals to resist the barbarian invaders at all costs. Big efforts were made, by the way. I think it's going to come up as a click, but it may not. Significant efforts were made to build up a series of fortifications called the Taku Forts. The Taku Forts guard the Hai River. The Hai River is a waterway that travels from the Sea of China all the way to Beijing, the capital. So these forts defended the mouth to the capital. Now, FYI, during the war, the Brits did seize the Taku forts, but they turned them back over to the Chinese. So, for the next year, all efforts were made to build up their defenses. Just in time. 1859. The Allies return and would attempt to blow their way up the Hai River to possibly open fire on the capital. But the Taku forts held, and they sunk four ships. Oh, there are Taku forts. So, in 1860, the Brits and the French would send a massive force. 173 ships carrying 18,000 men. This time, and by the way, all of these dots are part of the forts, the fort system. This time, instead of trying to sail inward, because once you get to here, you could get fired upon by three forts simultaneously. What the Allies do is they would do an amphibious landing. They landed soldiers on the coast, and the soldiers then assaulted the forts from the rear, allowing them to seize the forts. And then once they were shut down, the ships sailed in, and then they would repeat and repeat. Well, when the capital got word that the guardhouses were taken, the forts were taken, they quickly sent Prince Gong to meet with Harry Parks. Harry Parks was the ambassador sent by England to negotiate with the Chinese. Well, they didn't have audio recordings. They didn't have video recordings. We're not exactly sure what took place. But apparently, Harry Parks insulted the prince. From what I've read, most sources seem to agree that he refused to bow before the prince. Well, as a result of that insult, the Chinese guards not only captured the ambassador, but captured his whole entourage and marched him off to Beijing. And then some of the party, not Parks, would be found guilty of crimes against the emperor and sentenced to what the Chinese call slow slicing. Have any of you ever heard of the expression death by a thousand cuts? That's in reference to the Chinese punishment of slow slicing. It was a torture tactic in which highly trained torturers would take a hot knife sharp enough to cut chunks of flesh off your body. Hot would not only burn, but it would cauterize the cut. They would slowly do this, chunk after chunk after chunk, over several days. If for some reason they struck an artery, tourniquets were applied, they gave you medical treatment, they didn't want you to bleed out until the very last moment. Eventually you would get to the point where they start cutting off fingers and ears and nose, your toes, cut off your foot at the ankle, chunk by chunk by chunk, until your body goes into system shock and you die. Well, needless to say, when the stories of what happened to the British ambassador's party was published in the Western newspapers, there were cries of injustice and demands for revenge. In a warning sign to the emperor, the Europeans would travel to Nanking, which was on the scale of the Forbidden Palace, just not as big, and they leveled it. They used their cannons from their ships and bombarded the palace, and then they would go in and set fire to whatever was left. This was to be the warning sign to the emperor of what would happen in Beijing. Well, the emperor was terrified, so he would flee, leaving his brother in his place to negotiate the terms. The Second Opium War came to an end with an event today called the Peking, although today we call Peking Beijing, but the Peking Conference of 1860. To make it very simple, I thought that was a click. The Chinese agreed to the Tientsin Treaties. Everything that I covered, they agreed to. With two additions. The first addition would be with the British treaty. Under the British version of the Tientsin Treaties, the Brits would be given a monopoly to transport coolies to these United States of America. Does anyone know what coolies are? By the way, there are still coolies in existence today. Under Chinese law and custom, Chinese gangs have the right to take hostage families that don't pay their bills. They then take either the men or sometimes the women, and they use them as essentially slaves, in which the coolie has to work off the debt. So they're like debt slaves. Well, here's the thing. The Brits would be allowed to make deals with these gangs, take the coolies, put them on their ships, and sail them across the United to the United States, and drop them off in places like California. Now, the irony is when this practice began, these United States were embroiled in a bitter civil war. And one of the outcomes of the Civil War was the 13th Amendment. Anyone know what the 13th Amendment did? Reference the Civil War. What's the thing that most high school teachers incorrectly say is the reason why we fought the Civil War? Yeah, the 13th Amendment officially abolished slavery in the United States. No citizen could own another human being in the United States. But guess who built most of the railroads in our country? Chinese slaves. And the United States did not impose any type of penalty on this. Because did any American own these people? By the way, a lot of the innocent people that are being smuggled in our borders illegally, they're coming for the same reasons. There's probably gangs in their home country that are holding their families hostage. So they're forced to come to America, get jobs, or get the free government handouts and send the money back home to the gangs so the gangs don't kill their families. And the United States can't do anything about it because the crime is committed overseas. All right, the other thing that was added to the British treaty, opium trade. Not only the Brits have a monopoly on coolies, the Brits would be given a monopoly on opium. Questions? All right, well, truth be told, the opium wars were catastrophic for the Chinese. China was forced to continually give up more rights because the Europeans figured out how to get whatever they wanted from England. I'm sorry, China, rather. To either threaten or actually declare war on the Chinese. Rough them up a little bit and sign new treaties. Soon, China was forced to open up every single potential commodity that was produced in China for trade. Whereas during the Ming and the Qing periods, the early Qing periods, you know, the emperor's government set what could be imported and exported. Now, anything produced in China is for sale. Europeans were also allowed to set up warehouses all across the country. Most favored nation status. So they could get around paying tariffs or any extra fees. because they would go to the local farmer and buy from him direct. By 1890, over 90 ports were opened up in China. There were close to 400,000 European citizens living in China. And by this point, there wasn't only British and French, Russians and Americans, but the Germans showed up. The Austrians showed up. The Italians showed up. By 1900, the entire Chinese economy was controlled by foreigners. And there was nothing the government could do about it. And, most importantly, most insulting rather, were European ambassadors demanded and would later receive the right to enter the Forbidden City at any time they wanted to. For the Chinese and the Qing, this was the most insulting condition imaginable. Questions? Well, why didn't they do anything about it? Well, the problem is when you allow one area in your life to get out of control, other areas soon begin spiraling out of control. So, for instance, if you're all here and you're taking out student loans, you know how much money you're going to have to pay back when you get out and you get a JOB, right? Well, guess what's going to happen to your bank account when you go out and get credit cards or have to go buy an automobile or try getting an apartment or, God forbid, even imagining of buying a house. You're going to be at points in your life where you're spending more than you're making. Happened to my wife and I. It was scary as can be. But my wife and I got out of it because both of us are very frugal. We're cheap. So instead of going and getting $8 cups of coffee, I go and buy the Acme brand of jugs of coffee, you know, at places like Aldi's. And I it's rot gut coffee. It's awful, but it's cheap and it gives me caffeine, so it works. We ate a lot of chicken. We ate a lot of ramen noodles. We did anything we could to stay in our house. So we shrunk our expenses to pay ourselves out of debt. Took us about 25 years, but we managed not only to buy new cars, our mortgages paid off, our school loans are paid off. And now every single paycheck, we're putting about 75% of what we make into the bank. We're getting ready for retirement. Took us 30 years of work, but that's what you do. You act like an adult. You make proper decisions. You fix the problem. Well, I know friends that while they were trying to do the same thing, had health issues pop up, or they lost their job because the company went bankrupt, or the landlord sold the house and someone new bought it and upped the rents and they got kicked out. You know, life has a tendency to throw chaos at you. Well, the same thing happened in China. It's not saying that the Qing didn't try fixing the problems that allowed them to be exploited. They just never had the chance. Like the Ottomans, things after things after things kept hitting them. One of the worst was rebellion. China, beginning in the 1840s, started facing those inevitable rebellions that occur as the dynastic circle spins. All throughout the countryside, people rose up angry over high taxes, crime, the destruction or decaying of infrastructure. And out of all of the rebellions, one of the worst rebellions during the Qing period, and possibly all of China, was the Taiping Rebellion. this catastrophe was led by a man by the name of Huang Xiongguan. Huang started off life like many men of middle to upper class. He went to the imperial academies and he studied to take the imperial exams. But he was a failure. He failed at once. First you don't succeed, try again. So he went back, he studied again, came back a few years later, failed a second time. Got back on his feet, went back to the academy, studied some more, and came back and studied it a third time. Failing again. But after his third failure, he had a complete psychological breakdown. They didn't understand depression back then. But he spiraled into a deep depression. And while recovering, he had a vision. In his vision, he believed he ascended into heaven, which was a weird concept for Chinese, because Chinese don't have a concept of heaven. Or hell. You just die. But in this vision, he discovered, while in heaven, that he had a celestial family, a spiritual family, distinct from his earthly family, which included a heavenly father, a heavenly mother, a heavenly older brother. Heck, he even had a heavenly sister-in-law. He had a heavenly wife, and he had a heavenly son. This family encouraged him to do it again, to get back on his feet and try one more time, which he did. And then he failed again. Sorry, I thought there was a click. After failing the fourth time, due to what took place in the first Opium Wars, when Christian missionaries were allowed to penetrate China, he came in contact with Christian literature that talked about God's kingdom of heaven, in which God sits on a heavenly throne, sitting by his side is his son, Jesus. So, Huang became convinced that his celestial father was God, and that his celestial, his heavenly elder brother was Jesus. And he realized then that he had to engage in a mission. His job was to rid the world of demon worship. In other words, get rid of the Confucian and ancestor worship stuff that was in China, and basically bring about the Christianization of China. So he began to believe that he literally was the Son of God, and literally the younger brother of Jesus. And he started preaching. And as he preached, he soon would build up a literal army of followers. Just as the second Opium War erupts and China descends into chaos, Huang would unleash his fighters, who were known as the Taiping, which means heavenly fighter. And amazingly, they won a series of victories against the Qing army. Heck, the Taiping even had a specialized unit of women soldiers, which were called Haka, H-A-K-K-A. Hong used these brilliantly because the Qing soldiers refused to fight women because it's dishonorable. Men are bigger, men are stronger. You don't fight women. And the women kick their asses. And by the way, a woman will kick a man's ass if a man's not allowed to fight back. Well, just as the Second Opium War is rolling, in the interior, Hong's forces are conquering China. So much so, they manage to seize hold of most of southern China itself. Hong was declared to be an earthly emperor, and he declared his kingdom to be called the Heavenly Kingdom. They would establish their capital, although it's Tianjin there, but that's the modern city of Nanjing. Actually, no, strike that. It was called Nanjing. Now it's called Tianjin. That's the current map. At its height, over 30 million people lived in this zone. He had control over more lives than the population of England and France combined. Well, imagine the impact on the economy with China losing that huge zone. Most of that zone is where much of the agricultural, the rice in particular, is grown. This would be the equivalent as what would happen in the United States if the southern states won the war of northern aggression. They won the Civil War. And if the Confederacy won their independence, the United States economy would have never allowed it to become a superpower. Because a lot of wealth comes from food production. Because that's the one thing we need. We don't need all our little cell phones and our electronic devices, but we all need food. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, the Taiping would attempt to actually conquer all of China. But soon they began running out of steam. Part of the reason why is Hong and his commanders started fighting over objectives. And in some instances, some of the commanders actually would be involved in assassinations of other commanders. It got so bad that Hong himself became addicted to drugs. So things started spiraling out of control. At the very same time, a lot of the people living in the Heavenly Kingdom no longer wanted to live in the Heavenly Kingdom. Because Hong started implementing laws that pissed the people off. He was a proto-communist. He began declaring that nobody owned property, that all property was to be shared amongst all the people. In a patriarchal society, he declared women are equal to men. And as I've already said, he started making it illegal to be a Confucianist or a Buddhist or a practicer of the traditional Chinese folk religions or worship your ancestors. Everyone was ordered to become Christians. And so as a result, the people hated the Qing, but they despised this man. So he lost the people. One of the things that would ultimately result in the downfall was his attempt to attack Confucianism. Economic and gender equality are the diametrical opposite of Confucian standards, where you know your place in society. And you are only to have that which is equal to the rank in which you sit. So the emperor has everything, the peasant has nothing. And you're not supposed to complain about it, if you remember. Filial piety. You know your role, you do your job. Plus, the Taiping began smashing ancient works of Confucian scholarship. They started attacking shrines and tablets. Well, as they did so, they also were attacking the scholar gentry. And the scholar gentry were not willing to take this on their seats. Where the emperor dealing with the opium wars was incapable of dealing with the Taiping at the same time, some of the scholar gentries, the regional and local leaders, decided to take action in their own right. Many of them literally began recruiting their own armies to fight back against the Taiping. Thought that was open. The most powerful of these men was Zhang Gufang. Zhang Gufang was a provincial governor, and he had the respect of all of the government people below him, as well as some of the most wealthy and powerful landlords in his province. He used that to literally build his own army, paid for, not by the emperor, but by him. And these forces were loyal to him personally, not the emperor. Thus, Zhang Gufang would essentially become a warlord. And he would use his armies to cut into the Taiping as they advanced northernly. Now, ultimately, and again, keep in mind, this is going on at the same time as the Second Opium War. So the emperor in the government is trying to deal with the French and the Americans and the Russians and the British, while at the same time the provincial leaders are dealing with the Taiping. But due to the reasons I already mentioned, the Taiping movement would run out of energy. And in the end, the warlords would use their forces to brutally crush the Taiping in 1864. Now, FYI, as an example of how brutal they were, when the city of Nanking was seized, over 100,000 people, members of the Taiping, would be killed in the battle. Many of which died in the conflagration fires that erupted in the city when the warlords opened fire with their cannons on the city. Hong himself died during the siege because he was trying to get his next fix, and he accidentally ate poison weeds instead of the usual hallucinogens that he had been taking. But by the way, this was one of the most horrific events in the history of world civilization. An event that none of you probably have ever heard of. From beginning to an end, at least, at a minimum, 20 million people died. Mostly civilians. And why do I say at least? They didn't keep accurate records. Some modern scholars believed it could be as much as 50 million. And if you look through all of the horrific events in time, if it's really that high, that puts it above even the total death rate in World War II. Putting it just below the genocidal actions that the United States engaged in from the time Roe v. Wade was passed up till it was repealed, where 64 million babies were aborted in our country. Well, foreign invasions, uprisings, death, destruction, chaos. There were calls for reform. We'll deal with that on Tuesday. Now, by the way, as we're going to see, the Chinese would attempt to fix some of the problems. But by this point, the dynastic circle was like at 11. It was very unlikely that the Qing would be able to reform their way out. And of course, we got a lot more death to cover before they get there. So, if you haven't done so already, make sure you've read the New Imperialist chapter. It covers what took place in Africa and the Middle East. And make sure you start the Asian chapter. If you're going to send me extra credit questions, you know, get them in. I'll be honest with you, we're not going to have our exam next week because we only meet once, but it definitely will be after we come back from the Easter break, because we're going to come back and we're going to do Japan, and that will be the exam. All right? Have a wonderful weekend. Papers, papers, papers. Some of you still, all of you still have a chance to get some extra credit if you get your papers in. Of course, check proflamanic.com before you do so. Take care, stay warm. We'll see you all on Tuesday.